Morning. Thanks for coming to such an early session. And I want to start by thanking Captain Dandridge, who's an incredibly committed healthcare provider. Like probably a lot of people here, works in a tough system and brings a lot of passion and commitment to bear and makes a huge, huge difference for the patients and also the healthcare providers that she interacts with. So thank you. So I just wanted to talk a little bit about our experience managing several infectious disease outbreaks at Rikers. This is a issue that brings into focus the difference between like clinical concern about how serious diseases are and then the security component of corrections, which is how do you maintain security and placate the concerns of the security apparatus while providing some level of health care. You know, it's instructive to think about tuberculosis as the model. Like, you can go to almost any jail in the United States, and the two things that people care about are suicides and tuberculosis. There may be a wide spectrum of other types of care for other diseases, but people who run jails don't want TB in them. That's not so much the case outside the United States, but kind of keep that in mind. And I'll point out actually some references to the original TB epidemics in New York City that helped us in management of some of these conditions. So I have no disclosures to report. So we'll talk a little bit about, very briefly, about the jail system in New York, then go through each of these infectious disease outbreaks we had and some common issues among them. So Rikers is the island that has 9 jails. There are 2 other jails in the New York City system. It's a big system, second largest. LA is bigger, but you know, about 13,000 people on a given day. And we as the DOH are responsible for healthcare in this setting. So unlike most settings where you have the detaining authority oversee healthcare, we as the DOH are written into the city charter as the medical authority. And then the Department of Corrections does the security. So you all probably remember when H1N1 came to be in 2009. Certainly people who work in medicine or healthcare, I think we're very aware. For us out on Rikers Island, actually, my boss at the time was Tom Frieden, who's now with the CDC. And so we had early cases, just like the city did, in April of 2009. And so our first case, and so I have up there ILI versus H1N1. So ILI refers to influenza-like illness. That's the clinical presentation of fever, cough, sore throat. So that's what you see in the patient. H1N1, we would give somebody a diagnosis of H1N1 once we did a positive, got a positive on a nasopharyngeal swab. Unlike everywhere else in New York City, we did a nasopharyngeal swab on every single person with ILI. So what that meant was, you'll see we had a little over 100 people in a short period of time come up with ILI. We got nasopharyngeal swabs on every one of them. So we knew with great certainty what the incidence of this was. Having done that, having come up with a lot of positive tests, one of the things I'll show you is we then actually got kind of labeled as the source or the site of this, even though our incidence was actually very, very low compared to the city. And, you know, this is just people coming in and out of the city, but it's one of the cautionary tales about looking closely for something in corrections and getting a label. So the first week, that red dot, that's our adolescent facility. We had one case. And then over on the left, the second week, that's our largest jail, AMKC, that has 2,500 people in it. And we had a few cases there. Then by the third week, we were in 3 different facilities, but it was really moving all over that large jail, AMKC. Also, you know, the adolescent jail over on the right where we had our first case, all those kids go to school. So it's mandated by law that all these adolescents go to school. So we have 800 or 900 adolescents in that jail coming together in this common school area once a day. Plus, they fight like crazy. It's adolescent jail. And so that became our most tricky, from a management standpoint, it became a very tricky location because a lot of the places have separation orders because of gang involvement and because of some people can go to school with other people. But that jail, although the one on the left, the large jail, was our first big challenge. The one on the right, the adolescent jail, was where we really ended up spending a lot of energy trying to figure out how to handle these cases. Basically, within 4 weeks, every single jail, including the two borough houses, that's the barge up on the right and Manhattan House, every single jail had multiple housing areas that were impacted. And you see the circle over there on the island. That is actually, that's our communicable disease unit. So those little white boxes you see are these things called sprungs. They were built during the height of the TB epidemic, and it is the largest negative pressure, largest collection of negative pressure cells in the world. So there are 80 individual cells, and there are two large dorms, all negative pressure, all constantly monitored and with generator backup. And so that was developed, I think, in 91 or 92, but it gave us the benefit of taking all of our ILI cases and saying, you know what, we'll put you in here in negative pressure. Like many people, we didn't know how severe this would be. We didn't know if we would have fatalities. You probably all remember people brushing off their pandemic flu plans. So while this was meeting certain criteria for pandemic flu, everybody's pandemic flu plan had these things in there that were so dire, basically bodies piling up in the streets, and like you have to go get these refrigerator trucks to use as morgues, and nobody had anticipated a pandemic flu that would not kill people, but that's what we didn't know that at this point. But that CDU, that isolation center, was really a great resource for us to put people while we were trying to figure out how severe this would be. So I mentioned a little bit about how we define cases. We did nasopharyngeal swabbing. You can see that we had 140 in the spring ILI. Most of those people had a positive H1N1. That gave us, when we put this in together with the next fall, we ended up with an incidence of about 4%, 3%, and the Department of Health for the whole community of New York estimated about 7 or 8% of the people got H1N1. So we ended up with a lower infection rate in our setting. So one of the tricky things was when people came up with symptoms, the housing area they were in, we would isolate, which meant no new admissions in, no people could come out. We came up with a very clear set of criteria about what that means and where people could and couldn't go. But when it comes to partner agencies, we found that the courts actually, in May and June, the courts didn't want to accept these people. So we would screen people and say, you know, see that they had no symptoms and be ready to put them on a bus and go to the courts. And the courts there's 1 week where the courts shut down and there were people that were held in jail because they couldn't get the court to, you know, be freed. And it was, you know, a strange sense of hysteria. So I'll briefly mention two other outbreaks. This is a jail, it's an intake jail, which means people get arrested in the community and then they come here first, and then they may go from here to other places. This is a jail on Rikers that has had sporadic cases of Legionnaire's disease for several years. You've probably heard of hospitals having this, but you know, we had 7 cases over the case of 8 years. There were multiple attempts to clean out, basically by warming up the water and kill the Legionella bacteria, ineffective. So like hospitals do, finally in 2010, the Department of Corrections put in one of these big copper silver ionizing systems. We continue to have sporadic positive tests in the water, and since then we've had one new case. So this is really interesting. For us in the health department, the question is, do we ever say, like, you just can't use this jail anymore? You know, it's got 1,000 people, and this area, this building has 800 to 1,000 people in it. There's no capacity for corrections to put people elsewhere. Nobody's died from these, but at some point we may need to say, I mean, it's a contentious thing, but we then do a lot of the same stuff we did for ILI. We surveil for symptoms. We try and keep people who are, you know, have risk for Legionnaire's disease out of this building, but those are kind of imperfect measures, and I think, you know, we have to contend with the fact that people will still have these problems. So the middle of the box there, switching to shower settings. When we had this very serious case in 2010, the person was in the ICU, but we went in and looked at the showers, and the showers in this whole building were set to mist. It was like going into one of these places where they grow flowers, where like the water just kind of mists out. It was like perfect aerosolization of the water. So we asked DOC to turn it to jet, but then the water comes out very hard, and the patients don't like that. Obviously, it's not pleasant to shower in there, but you know, the patients we talked to who got Legionnaires' disease, one of the things that many of them said is, yeah, I was in the shower for a half hour, for 45 minutes, and you know, just breathing in this water for a long period of time. That was a very low-tech approach that, compared to the millions spent on this copper ionizing system, I think may have been more effective. So this is C. diff. This is a common problem in hospitals. We have an infirmary. I'll show you the infirmary. You can't see anything, but we have a large infirmary at Rikers, a male infirmary that holds 100 patients. This infirmary actually used to be a bus depot. I'm not making this up. It's where DOC kept their buses. So it's rooms with ceilings this high, higher actually, very like maybe four or five times bigger than this room, with many, many cots that are 18 to 24 inches apart. In there we have people with CHF, with pulmonary hypertension, who are on chemo, all the like sickest people in our system that aren't in the hospital. And you know, we had one episode where somebody had C. diff and then transmitted it to two people around them. The bottom box there in the middle says need, and I deleted it, but what we needed in it when this happened was isolation cells. We needed the ability to do contact precautions, like in the hospital. Somebody comes up with unknown diarrhea that's suspicious. They go into a room by themselves. They put all these labels up. They put the card outside for the gowns. All that happens for us. This infirmary has very few cells that we can put people in, and DOC had kind of taken those cells and they used them for like punitive purposes for people that got infractions. And so, for us, a major problem was we did not have the capacity to put people in a contact precaution setting. I will say the other thing, hand washing. When this happened, we did an assessment, and over half of the patients in our infirmary did not have the ability to wash and dry their hands. That is, either the sinks were broken, there was no soap, or there were no paper towels. So we waged a like 3 or 4 week battle with DOC just to get that. Like this is, I mean, since Semmelweis, we're talking about hand washing, but we even had this great walkthrough where we walked through these senior corrections folks on a Friday, and they have a big cart with paper towel dispensers and soap dispensers, and it's on the cart. They say, we're putting this, see, look, we bought this stuff, we're going to put it up. And then we got back on Monday, and they just moved it all back into a closet, like, which was almost more work than putting it up. But, like, that was, it's embarrassing to say, but those are the things we were contending with. Like, this was not rocket science. This was not high-level medical intervention. So, very briefly, I think that, you know, I'll skip ahead to this. So I think that when these outbreaks come, you know, one of the first things is you need to figure out what your case is. So how do you define a case, you know, suspected case and a confirmed case? What testing are you going to do? The middle area there, screening, is really what are you going to do in the housing area that the person comes from? Are you going to expand that to be the whole building somebody's in? And I think that you see that red asterisk there. Compromise with security. This is where, in corrections, I think we operate at the mercy or the tolerance of the correctional security staff. And so, you know, we will have to bend to their will in these times. There was at the beginning of H1N1, one of the first nights, it's like 10 or 10:30, and I heard there was a case of ILI. It was the first case in the adolescent jail. So it's 10:30 at night. So I charge over there. I say, I'm going to go screen the whole house. And they say, you know, I don't think you want to go over there. It's like a high security classification house. It's 10:30 at night. People are whatever. So I run in there, and I have my thermometer. I have my screening forms. I'm ready to go. I'm like, oh, yay, rah, rah. And I start to, whatever, I'm taking people's temperatures. I take this one kid's temperature, and then somebody comes and like attacks the person whose temperature I'm taking, and then somebody takes my thermometer and starts beating somebody else with it. The whole house is in this big conflagration. It's just a fight. And the thing is, like, it wasn't until the next day that I was like, oh, the security people said, don't do that. Like, but I was like so eager to go in there, and we wanted to like assess this house immediately for, you know, nobody had dropped dead. Nobody was obtunded. It was just somebody had a fever and a cough, and that could have waited for the next day. But in our rush to like get our screening and surveillance mechanism into place, you know, I did not take some smart advice. Incidentally, I'll say it's an adolescent jail, and you forget that these are kids. So I went back the next day to finish that screening, and two kids came up to me and said, you know, we're really sorry about that last night. We shouldn't have done that while you were here. And I was like, well, that's really sweet. Like, that's adorable. Like, I get that they're 17-year-olds or 16-year-olds. I think that the final thing I'll mention is this, on this last slide, diagnostic testing. So, you know, in jails, we sometimes come up with really comprehensive plans to handle these things, and we come up with good information that we then report out to our partners. And so I mentioned that we kind of got this label of this Rikers outbreak. So we had people from the State Department of Corrections, from papers in the city, calling this the Rikers outbreak. And we, because we were aggressively looking for ILI and finding it and reporting out our rates, people routinely ascribed the spread of this to us. And so the unions for the corrections officers, there are multiple power players in the city that said this is a Rikers problem. And, you know, I think we now know that it was less of a problem for us than elsewhere. It's just we're part of the community, so we get the problems that the community has. But it goes to the importance of messaging and of, you know, to the extent possible, proactively telling people, like, these are the measures we're doing. They're the same measures we're doing everywhere else. And just repeating those simple messages over and over. All right, thanks.